someone from another state or country came to your part of Wisconsin and wanted you to show them not the local chain restaurant, but the hidden gem serving food in a way that's unique to here, what would that be? Our next guest collected unique food traditions on every continent, even Antarctica, in a new book, From Wisconsin Bitters to Food in Korean Temples and Beyond. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are some of your favorite food discoveries down the street or around the world? Where have you had the best, most off-the-beaten-path meal away from home? Did you discover something totally new just around the corner from home? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Dylan Thuris has a couple hundred ideas to guide us in our search. He's co-founder and creative director of the Atlas Obscura Travel Books and their website guide to strange and wonderful destinations around the globe. He's co-author of the new book called Gastro Obscura, a food adventurer's guide. Dylan, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me on again. It's nice to talk to you.
As I mentioned, you've got things from every continent on the planet, every state, I believe, in the Union. But what were you looking for in putting together this guide to unique food-related things around the world?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, it's funny because in a way, we're starting with more than can ever fit in a book. Because same with Atlas Obscura. With Gastro, we reached out to our kind of audience, our community of travelers, and said, what's an incredible ingredient? What's an unusual dish? What's an amazing, strange restaurant you've been to? And sort of gathered stuff that way. And then it was a process of kind of distilling down. And the thing that we were looking for were just great stories that had something surprising in them. We weren't very interested. There's plenty of sort of novelty foods that are out there that are made just to be, you know, some limited edition, weird flavored chip or something. And that didn't really appeal to us. We were looking for stuff that had, you know, deep roots in a place, sort of cultural, historical, and that maybe told you something about it. So that's sort of what we were after.
And just connecting it to your Atlas Obscura mission, the idea that we can find wonder in the world, and that might be a once in a lifetime trip on the other side of the planet. It might be in our own backyard. Can you talk about how that kind of overall mission guided you in finding these food traditions?
Yeah, that's that. You hit the nail right on the head. You know, the whole premise of Atlas Obscura is that less than being sort of a bucket list, it's more about a way of looking at the world and exploring it and looking for surprising stories and wondrous things. And these are all around us. And we realized sort of one day, about 4 or 5 years ago, that they were literally in front of us, that they were on our plates, that, you know, the stories of how a dish came to be are often these incredible, rich tapestries of culture, of nature, of history. And we just realized it was a really just another lens we could take to the world and sort of celebrate the world's plurality, its diversity, all of the incredible, unusual, interesting ways that people have gone about creating food. So that's really the focus of the book.
One thing I love is that there's some sort of convergence sometimes. We think of butter sculpture as a Midwestern state fair tradition in a lot of states around here. We're not the only ones who do butter sculptures. What did you end up learning?
Yeah, that's right. And I grew up in Minnesota, so I, you know, went to watch 90-pound blocks of butter be carved into the shape of heads year after year. And so, yeah, I did think that this was a kind of quintessentially Midwestern thing. And what I discovered was that since the 1400s, probably, Tibetan monks have been making their own version of butter sculpture. And it's made out of yak butter in their case. And there's a great kind of legend that goes with this, which is that a princess basically came to the monastery and they wanted to give her flowers, but it was freezing outside. So instead they carved some flowers out of frozen butter. And to this day, there is a huge celebration. You can find butter sculpture around the year, but especially in the winter months, there is a big festival called the Butter Lantern Festival, when Tibetan monks take this yak butter and carve it into sometimes like meters tall sculpture. And they color it with mineral pigments. And it's just spectacular. So it was nice to kind of find these parallels across the world.
Talking to Dylan Thuris, co-author of Gastro Obscura, a food adventurer's guide. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your favorite food or food tradition you've discovered in your own community or around the world. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Jeff is with us in Superior. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, gentlemen. I love this topic. Whenever I travel, I'm always seeking out something new and exciting. When I lived in Chicago, I discovered this restaurant on the Red Arrow Highway in Southwest Michigan. It was from people from Afghanistan, started their own restaurant. Traditional coffees and spices and everything they made was so unique. Now, I fished on the Brule River here in northern Wisconsin, so I've tasted fresh rainbow trout. We cooked it at home when I was a kid. But this place, this Afghani restaurant, they put pistachios over the top, like it was crusted with these spices, and it was stuffed. I mean, it was the best rainbow trout I ever had. And it to me, it's like they are connoisseurs or craftsmen when it comes to cooking food from Afghanistan. It just was excellent.
Hey, Jeff, I'm going to abuse my position here and ask for some personal help. I drive through southwestern Michigan on my way to visit my folks. What town was that in if I want to try to track it down?
Well, you got to get on the Red Arrow Highway, New Buffalo, get
okay.
off quarter closer to the lake. So if you're going up to Holland or you're going up to South Haven, you want to get on the Red Arrow Highway. And there's a number of places on there that make really good burgers. There's Redimax, goes back 70 years. I mean, the Red Arrow Highway has some really interesting things in Southwest Michigan.
Jeff, thank you so much for sharing that with us. And Dylan, a couple points I want to follow up with from Jeff. First of all, get off the highway, get off the beaten path, and you might sometimes find something cool.
Definitely. The best, you're going to find a lot better eating off the interstate than you will on it. I'll tell you that.
And then his other point, I mean, we've got Afghan cooking with rainbow trout, perhaps caught, I assume, in the Great Lakes or the rivers nearby. And you, I know a point of interest for you is fusion, sometimes with a dark history behind it. But when cultures come together, interesting food comes out of it.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the things that we learned in putting this book together that, you know, fusion is not a style of food. It is the history of food. And you're right. A lot of times the reasons for sort of food cultures to collide are have, you know, some dark stories, whether it's colonialism or it's war. But what happens is once these food cultures collide, new things emerge and you really end up with more than you started with. So around the world, you know, you'll find sort of these interesting combinations of German spit cakes mixed with Indonesian spices from the period of sort of Dutch colonialism in India. You'll find in Russia, there was a group of Koreans who basically a big Korean diaspora went into Russia, and then they were pushed even further by Stalin, sort of forcefully pushed into really the middle of nowhere in Uzbekistan and Kazakhstan. But they had to adapt to the ingredients. So they created something called morkovcha, which is this kind of spicy carrot-based kimchi. And that's Ooh. Now beloved across Russia and Uzbekistan and Kazakhstan. You know, even really familiar dishes like chicken tikka masala is basically about the British, the Indian and Pakistani diaspora in Britain. And they were serving in the 50s and 60s kind of a dry chicken tikka style. And they would stay open late to get the customers coming basically drunk out of the pubs. And all these drunk British customers said, you know, I grew up eating meat covered in sauce. This is just the standard kind of British diet is meat and sauce. Can you make this saucier? And the legend is that maybe some clever chef somewhere combined the dry spice chicken tikka with a can of Campbell's tomato soup, and chicken tikka masala was born. So every food really has got some story like this somewhere in its history.
We're talking to Dylan Thuris, co-founder of Atlas Obscura, about the new book he co-wrote, Gastro Obscura, A Food Adventurer's Guide. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Tell us about your favorite food adventure, near, far, somewhere in between. Do you have a local unique place to eat or food tradition that people love or are maybe grossed out by? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Dylan Thuris about the new book from Atlas Obscura. He co-wrote it. It's called Gastro Obscura, A Food Adventurer's Guide. You can join in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page if you have a favorite food memory from traveling or something cool in your community, 800-642-1234. Heard from some people on Facebook. Adrian writes, chopped liver in Toluca, Mexico. Before you say yuck, Adrian writes, my liver-hating daughter ate it and loved it. Now, Dylan, can you talk about the idea of maybe pushing our boundaries, especially when we travel and trying that thing we might think we wouldn't like?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that the book sort of aims to show is that what we think of as strange or unusual food is obviously entirely relative to where you're from. I mean, I'm from the upper Midwest, and I grew up eating lutefisk, which is, you know, at one point in its life cycle will kill you if you eat it because it's full of lye. And so, you know, it's really, you don't have to like stuff. The idea is not that you're going to like everything, but each dish is an interesting story. And I think it's always, as I say to, you know, my kids, it's always worth trying something once. Even if you don't like it, learning the story, giving it a try is a worthwhile practice.
I also got a story from our colleague Jennifer Hadley at PBS Wisconsin. She tells us, traveling in rural Hungary in the 1990s, I accidentally attended a negotiation between two families who were working out the details of an arranged marriage. Want to hear the story of how that happened accidentally? She goes on, I was served bread with a half-inch thick slice of something cool, pure white, and rubbed with paprika. Yes. This is my introduction to salo, slabs of fat back. I'm vegetarian, Jennifer says. But when someone feeds you, you eat it. Thankfully, it came with a lot of homemade, I'm not sure if that's rose wine or rosé wine. It could go either way. But there's, I don't know, the story there, right. I think, is a big part of that, Dylan, and being accidentally part of an interesting tradition.
So I lived in Hungary for a year. And ate fat on bread like on the regular. It's not so different from butter when you think about it. It's, you know, it's a slightly different source of the fat. But yeah, lardo or various kinds of fat on bread is really popular across Eastern Europe particularly, but Europe more generally. And I think it's not great if you're vegetarian, but really good otherwise. And yeah, you sprinkle a little red onions on there. And, you know, I think food is just another keyhole with which to kind of look through and start to experience the world. And because it's so sensory, I find that my memories of taste and smell are some of the strongest connections I have to place and travel. And so I think they're all kind of intertwined in this inseparable way.
And Linda, to that point, wrote on Facebook, she just wrote pumpkin soup in Antigua. And there's like clearly for her and for a lot of people, as you were saying, Dylan, that food is the thing that might conjure up the memory of that great trip you had.
Yeah, there's something about, I mean, they say smell is sort of the, it's almost like it acts at a subconscious level. It kind of connects to some very deep parts of memory. And so I find that to be true. And I find it's also an invitation. Each food, piece of food, each dish, each ingredient is a kind of invitation to ask a couple more questions, learn a little bit about how it's made, and maybe start to get the bigger story of how it came to be. And I think usually when you get that bigger story, A, it starts an interesting conversation maybe with strangers, and B, usually gives you some interesting cultural context about the place you're in. So food is a really wonderful way to sort of open up doors of curiosity and discovery.
Talking to Dylan Thuris, co-author of the new book, Gastro Obscura, A Food Adventurer's Guide. Still time for you to share your food travel experience or your local unique food or interesting family food tradition if you've got one to share at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Dylan, I want to visit some more of the stories in your book. Sometimes it's not about the food, but where you eat it. Here's one, a restaurant in an old English bathroom.
Yeah, sure. It's a high-end coffee shop in what was at the time a high-end urinal. So it's down, it's like a subterranean space. You have to go down a staircase. And it contained these sort of very deluxe urinals for Victorian gentlemen. And then it was abandoned for like 50 years. It was basically shuttered until it was opened within the last 10 years to serve as a kind of high-end, fancy-pantsy, like coffee bar. And yeah, I mean, that's one of the things we're always keeping an eye out for is I find, you know, eating is a confluence of the foods, the journey it took to get to the place and the surrounding too. So I will eat at places where the food's just okay, but like talking to the bartender or the chef is amazing, or the decor is incredible. You know, there's some supper clubs in Wisconsin where I'm so on the food, but man, there's not another place like it in the world. So I feel like there's a lot of different things that go into the dining experience.
Oh, that reminds me, I better bring this up. You know, when I get a book to do for the show, step one is go through the index, look for Wisconsin. You've got a Wisconsin selection in the book, Bitters in Door County.
Yeah, so this is, well, you might call it the most bitter place in the world. it's pretty remote. It's on Washington Island at the tip of Door Peninsula. And they sell more bitters than anywhere else in the world. They sell like 10,000 shots of bitters. And the reason is because it was a loophole during Prohibition. Bitters were considered a medicine, and they were sold at pharmacies. And so when Prohibition, came into the county, this guy, Tom Nelson, who runs Nelson's Hall, applied for a pharmacist license just so that he could give out shots of bitters. And bitters is strong. Bitters is 45% alcohol. And he almost got shut down. That, you know, a judge came and said, basically, this is nonsense. You're just trying to get around this. And he said, okay, judge, you know, take a taste of this and tell me that it's not awful. And the judge tried it and basically said, oh, this is so horrible. I guess you're right. It really is strictly medicinal. And then, you know, they just kept on going. And the guy, Tom Nelson, consumed as much as a pint of bitters a day and did not pass away until he was 90 years old. So maybe he's onto something. But you can still go get a shot of bitters at Nelson's Hall and Bitters Club.
And I wanted to ask an interest of yours. You like collecting stories about interesting food traditions in different kinds of monasteries around the world. What kind of things drew your eye?
Sure. One of the things I love about monastic foods and drinks is that they're usually really tied to a place. Some foods across enormous regions, and it's sort of hard to even pin them down, and there's very varied versions of them. But with monastic foods, they're often literally in one temple, one monastery. So one thing that's interesting is across Western Europe, and there's monastic food traditions across Asia and across Africa, but in Western Europe, there's a lot of monastic drinking. Speaking of sort of drinking and bitters, there's an amazing, you might even have had this drink. Have you ever had chartreuse?
I've heard of it. I've never had it.
So, look out for it next time you're in the liquor store. It's kind of a fancy, it's a splurge to get a bottle. But when you know what the backstory is, it makes a lot of sense. So chartreuse is made by a group of monks called the Carthusians. And they're traditionally they were silent monks, and they're based in the French Alps. And they were given a recipe all the way back at like in 1084 that was supposed to be an elixir for elongating life. And they didn't get around to brewing it until the early 1700s. And finally they made this concoction that, supposedly has 130 different plants in it, and it takes maceration and distillation and all these advanced techniques. And they ended up brewing up a bottle of chartreuse. And the original recipe of chartreuse, which they then brought around by mule to the local villages, was 69% alcohol, which at that, wow, in the 1700s, I mean, that's basically like serious heavy duty drugs you're talking about.
Pretty heavy duty in 2021.
Yeah, so they eventually made a lighter version, which is what we generally drink, green chartreuse, which is still 55%. So it's not to be messed with. But the last thing I'll say is, this is the only place that makes it. And in fact, they've structured the making of chartreuse in such a way where at no point does one person know the entire recipe. There are always two monks who each know half of the recipe. And they are the people who create this. And they own the world's longest liquor cellar. And they pass it down generation after generation. And that is where all the chartreuse in the world comes from, is these monks in the French Alps. And I just think that's amazing. And I love the fact that, you can go and buy it and try it. And it's this kind of very strong, herbaceous drink. I'm a big fan, actually.
Now, you mentioned earlier, Dylan, that you collect stories for Atlas Obscura and for Gastro Obscura from your members. If people out there have a unique tradition they want to share, obviously too late for this book, but not for the website, what kind of things are you looking for? How do they share them?
So you can go on the site and you can add a place. And so if you have a sort of location-based thing, that's a good way to do it. Or you can email us info@atlasobscura.com. And basically just tell us about the recipe, the dish, the ingredient, what you think is interesting about it. And I'll be able to see those emails and we'll get back to you. Yeah, we love, you know, the best stuff on Atlas Obscura, in Gastro Obscura, comes because people are like, I grew up next to this thing. Or, hey, there's this guy down the road next to this small village in Thailand who fries chickens using a solar array, and he fries them in 12 minutes, and then you have this amazing whole roasted chicken. And it's like, that's the kind of stuff that you need people to tell you about, because you're not going to find it on your own. There's no website for the solar chicken guy, you know? It's Yeah, so please tell us about your interesting food stories. We'd love to hear them.
Dylan, thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Dylan Thuris, co-founder and creative director of Atlas Obscura. We talked to him about the new book he's co-author of called Gastro Obscura, A Food Adventurer's Guide. Betsy just wrote on Facebook, a food I grew up with in southern Minnesota, popcorn and milk. Bowl of buttered and salted popcorn with milk poured on it like a bowl of cereal. At one point, she says, I heard it was a pioneer food.